Chapter 16. Shygek. Men never resemble one another so much as when asleep or dead. Aparitha, on the Carnal. The arrogance of the Enrithi waxed bright in the days following Anwarat. Though the sober-minded demanded they press the attack, the great majority clamored for respite. They thought the Fainim doomed, just as they thought them doomed after Mangetta. But while the men of the Tusk tarried, the Padiraja plotted. He would make the world his shield. Drusus Acamian, the Compendium of the First Holy War. Early Autumn, 4111, Year of the Tusk, Iothea. Acamian suffered dreams. Dreams drawn from the sheath. Drizzle hazed the distances, obscuring the ring mountains behind drapes of woolen gray, granting the madness before him the span of all visible creation. Masses of Srank, bristling with black bronze weapons, ranks of Bashrag, beating the mud with their massive hammers, and beyond them, the high ramparts of Golgataroth, misty barbicans above precipitous cliffs, the two great horns of the Ark rearing into murky obscurity, curved and golden against the endless gray, trailing skirts of ungutted water. Hoary Golgataroth, raised about the greatest terror ever to fall from the heavens, soon to yield. A great yawing rumbled from the parapets out and across the dreary plains. Like a tide of spiders, the Srank surged forward, howling through pools, sprinting through mud. They crashed into the phalanxes of the warlike Eorsi, the long-haired bulwark of the north. They seethed against the shining ranks of the Kunaiori, the high tide of Norsarai glory. The chieftain princes of the High Norsarai whipped their chariots forward and all perished before them. The standards of Ishterabinth, last of the non-men mansions, charged deep into a sea of abominations, leaving black-blooded ruin in their wake. Great Nilgikas stood like a point of brilliant sunlight amid smoke and violent shadow, and Nymeric sounded the world horn over and over until the Srank could hear nothing but the peal of their doom. Seswatha, Grand Master of the Sohonk, raised his face to the rain and tasted sweet joy, for it was happening, truly happening. Unholy Golgataroth, ancient Min Uroikas, was about to fall. He had warned them in time. Acamian would relive all 18 years of that delusion. Dreams drawn from the knife's sheath. And when he awakened, to the sound of harsh shouts or to the patter of cold water across his face, it would seem that one horror had merely replaced another. He would blink against torchlight, would dully note the bite of chains, a mouth stuffed with rank cloth and the dark scarlet-robed figures that surrounded him. And he would think, before succumbing to the dreams once again, "It comes. The apocalypse comes."
"Strange, isn't it, Iorcus?"
"And what is that?"
"That men can be rendered so helpless so easily."
"Men and schools."
"What are you implying?"
"Nothing, Grandmaster."
"Look. He watches."
"Yes, he does that from time to time. But he must recover more of his strength before we can begin."
Esmanette cried out when she saw them walking their mounts across the field toward her. Kellis and Serwe, haggard from long and sleepless travel. Suddenly she was running across the uneven pasture as though drawn by a long, irresistible line. Toward them. No, not them. Toward him. She flew to him, clutched him harder than she thought her limbs capable. He smelt of dust and scented oils. His beard and hair kissed her bare skin with soft curls. She could feel her tears roll from her cheek to his neck in continuous lines.
"Kellis," she sobbed. "Oh, Kellis, I think I'm going mad."
"No, Esme, it is grief." He seemed a pillar of comfort, his square chest flattening her breasts, his long warding arms about her back and narrow waist. He pressed her back, and she turned to Serwe, who was also crying. They hugged, then together walked back to the lonely tent on the slope. Kellis led their horses, We missed you, Esme, Serwe said, strangely flustered. Esmenet regarded the girl with sorrow. Her left eye was bruised black and cherry, and an angry red cut poked from beneath her hairline. Even if Esmenet had the heart, and she had none, she would wait for Serwe to explain rather than ask what had happened. With such marks, asking demanded lies, and silence afforded truth. That was the lot of women, especially when they were wanton. Aside from her face, the girl appeared healthy, almost aglow. Beneath her hassas, her belly had swelled in the narrow-hipped manner Esmenet could only envy. 100 questions assailed Esmenet. How was her back? How often did she pee? Had there been any bleeding? Suddenly she realized how terrified the girl must be, even with Kellis. Esmenet could remember her own joyous terror. But then, she'd been alone. Absolutely alone.
You must be famished, she exclaimed.
Serwe shook her head in feeble denial, and both Esmenet and Kellis laughed. Serwe was always hungry, as a pregnant woman should be. For a moment, Esmenet felt the old sunshine flash from her eyes.
It's so good to see you, she said.
I've mourned more than the loss of a Kamian. Dusk had come, so she began drawing wood, mostly bone-colored flotsam she'd found along the river, to throw into the fire. Kella sat cross-legged before the dwindling flames. Serwe leaned her head against his shoulder, her hair nearly bleached white by the sun, her nose red and peeling as always. This is the same fire, Kella said, the one we struck after first coming to Shygek. Esmenet paused, her arms wrapped about her wood.
It is,
Serwe exclaimed. She looked around the bare slopes, turned to the dark band of the river in the near distance.
But everything's gone. All the tents, all the people.
Esmenet fed the fire piece by elaborate piece. She'd obsessed over her fires of late. There was no one else to tend. She could feel Kellis's gentle scrutiny. Some hearths can't be rekindled, he said.
It burns well enough, Esmenet murmured.
She blinked tears, sniffled and wiped at her nose. But what makes a hearth, Esme? Is it the fire or the family that keeps it?
The family, she finally said.
A strange blankness had overcome her.
We're that family. You know that.
Kellis had bent his head sideways to look into her downturned face.
And a Kamian knows that too.
Her legs became strangers, and she stumbled, fell onto a rump. She began weeping yet again.
But I have to stay. I have to wait for him. For him to come home.
Kellis knelt beside her, lifted her chin. She glimpsed a tear shining track across his left cheek.
We are that home, he said.
And somehow that was the end of it. Over the course of dinner, Kellis explained all that had happened the previous week. He was a most extraordinary storyteller, he always had been, and for a time Esmenet found herself lost in the Battle of Anwarat and its wrenching intricacies. Her heart pounded in her throat when he described the burning of the encampment and the charge of the Kurgui, and she clapped and laughed every bit as hard as Serwe when he described his defense of the Swazan standard, which, according to him, consisted of no more than a succession of outlandishly lucky blunders. And she found herself wondering that such a miraculous man, a prophet, for he could be nothing else, concerned himself with her, Esmenet, a caste menial whore from the slums of Sumna.
Ah, Esme, he said, it brings such peace to my heart to see you smile.
She bit her lip, laughed through a crying face. He continued, more seriously, to explain the events following the battle. How the heathens had been chased into the desert, how Gotian had held Scaurus's severed head before their victory fires, how even now the Holy War secured the south bank. From the delta to the deep desert, tabernacles burned. Esmenet had seen the smoke. They sat silently for a while, listening to the fire gorge on her wood. As always, the sky was desert clear, and the vault of stars seemed endless. Moonlight silvered the eternal Sempus.
How many nights had she pondered these things? Sky and sweeping landscape, dwarfing her, terrifying her with their monstrous indifference, reminding her that hearts were no more than fluttering rags. Too much wind, and they were tossed into the great black. Too little, and they fell slack. What chance did Akka have? I received word from Zynemus, Kellis finally said. He still searches.
So there's hope?
There's always hope, he said in a voice that at once encouraged and deadened her heart. We can only wait and see what he finds. Esmanet couldn't speak. She glanced at Serwe, but the girl avoided her eyes.
They think he's dead.
She knew better than to hope. This was the world, but dead seemed such an impossible thought. How could one think the end of thinking?
Akka would
come, Kella said, in the quick and open manner of someone assured of his new course. He strode around her small fire, sat with his knees in his hands next to her. With a stick, he scratched an oddly familiar sign into the bare earth before them.
In the meantime, let's teach you how to read.
It seemed all crying had been wrung from her, but somehow, Esmanet looked to Kellis and smiled through her tears. Her voice felt small and broken.
I've always wanted to read.
The seamless transition of agonies, from Seswatha's torture in the bowels of Dagliash 2,000 years before to now, the pain of puckered burns, chafed wrists, joints contorted by the wrong distribution of his body's weight. At first, Akamian didn't realize he was awake. It merely seemed that Makaratrig's face had transformed into that of Eleazarus. The inhumanly beautiful face of the man-traitor had become that of the Grand Master, rutted and whiskered.
Ah, Akamian, Eleazarus said. It's good to see you seeing things in this world, at least. For some time we feared you wouldn't awaken at all. You were very nearly killed, you know. The library was absolutely ruined. All those books, ash, simply because of your stubbornness. How the Seriots must howl in the outside, all their poor books.
Akamian was gagged, naked, and chained, wrists above his head and ankle to ankle, so that he hung suspended over a great mosaic floor. The chamber was vaulted, but he couldn't see the ceiling's peak, nor could he see the terminus of the walls that framed the silk-gowned entourage before him. The surrounding spaces were lost in gloom. Three glowering tripods provided light, and only he, hanging in the confluence of their circles of illumination, was bright.
Ah, yes, Eleazarus continued, watching him with a thin smile. This place. It's always good to have a sense of one's prison, no? An old enwreathed chapel, by the looks of it. Built by the Canaans, I suppose.
Suddenly he understood. The Scarlet Spires. I'm dead. I'm dead.
Tears welled down his cheeks. His body, beaten, numb from hanging, betrayed him, and he felt the rush of urine and bowel along his naked legs, heard mud slap across the mosaic serpents at his feet.
No, this can't be happening.
Eleazarus laughed, a thin, wicked thing.
And now, he said, his tone genanic and droll, some long-dead Canaan architect also howls.
There was uneasy laughter from his retinue. Seized by animal panic, Akamian writhed against his chains, hacked against a cloth in his throat. Spasm struck and he went limp. He swung in small circles, punished by wave after wave of pain.
Esme.
There's much certainty here, Eleazarus said, holding a kerchief to his face. Don't you think, Akamian? You know why you've been taken, and you also know the inevitable outcome. We'll ply you for the Gnosis, and you, conditioned by years of mandate training, will frustrate our every attempt. You'll die in agony, your secrets clutched close to your heart, and we'll be left with yet another useless mandate corpse. This is the way that it's supposed to happen, no?
Akamian simply stared in blank horror, an anguished pendulum slowly swinging to and fro, to and fro. What Eleazarus said was true. He was supposed to die for his knowledge, for the Gnosis. Think, Akamian, think. Please, please, dear God, you must think. Without the guidance of the Nanmen Kuya, the anagogic schools of the Three Seas had never learned how to surpass what were called the analogies. All their sorcery, no matter how powerful or ingenious, arose through the power of arcane associations, through the resonances between words and concrete events. They required detours, dragons, lightnings, suns, to burn the world. They could not, like a Akamian, conjure the essence of these things, the burning itself. They knew nothing of the abstractions. Where they were poets, he was a philosopher. They were mere bronze to his iron, and he would show them. Akamian snorted air through his nostrils. Through bleary eyes, he glared at the Grand Master.
I will see you burn. I will see you burn.
But here, Eliazarus was saying, in these tumultuous times, the past need not be our tyrant. Here, your torment, your death, isn't assured. Here, nothing is for certain.
Eliazarus walked from the others, five graceful, measured steps, and came to a stop very near to Akamian.
To prove this to you, I'll have your gag removed. I'll actually let you speak, rather than ply you, as we have your fellow schoolmen in the past, with endless compulsions. But I warn you, Akamian, it will be fruitless to try to assail us.
He produced a slender hand from the cuff of his glyph-embroidered sleeve, gestured to the mosaic floor. Akamian saw a broad circle, painted in red, across the stylized animals of the mosaic floor, the representation of a snake scaled by pictograms and devouring its own tail.
As you can see, Eliazarus said mildly, you're chained above Ouroborian circle. To even begin a cant will invite immeasurable pain, I assure you. I've witnessed it before.
So had Akamian. The Scarlet Spires, it seemed, possessed many potent poetic devices. The Grand Master retreated, and a lumbering eunuch appeared from the shadows. With fat but nimble fingers, he withdrew the gag. Akamian sucked air through his mouth, tasted the stink of his body's earlier treachery. He hung his head forward, spit as best he could. The Scarlet Schoolman watched him expectantly, even apprehensively.
Well? Eliazarus asked.
Akamian blinked, cocked his neck against the pain.
Where are we?
He croaked. A broad smile split the Grand Master's thin gray goatee.
Why, Iorthea, of course.
Akamian grimaced and nodded. He looked down to the Ouroborian circle beneath, saw his urine trickle along the grout between mosaic tiles. It didn't seem a matter of courage, only a giddy instant of disconnection, a willful ignorance of the consequences. He said two words. Agony. Enough to shriek, to empty bowels once again. Threads of incandescence winding, forking beneath his skin as though he possessed sunlight for blood. Shriek and shriek until it seemed that eyes must rupture, that teeth must crack, spill to mosaic floor, clicking like porcelain against porcelain. And then back to nightmares of a far older and far less momentary torment. When the shrieking stopped, Eliazarus stared at the unconscious figure. Even chained and naked, his shriveled phallus prodding from black pubic hair, the man seemed threatening.
Stubborn, Iacchus said, in a tone that insolently asked, what did you expect?
Indeed,
Eliazarus replied and fumed. Delay after delay. The gnosis would be such a lovely thing to wrest from this quivering dog, but it would be an unexpected gift. What he needed to know is what happened that night in the imperial catacombs beneath the Andiamine Heights. He needed to know what this man knew of the Kisharim skin spies. The Kisharim. Directly or indirectly, this one mandate dog had undone whatever advantage they'd gained at the Battle of Mengeta. First, by killing two sorcerers of rank at the Seriatic Library, among them Euteramus, an old and powerful ally of Eliazarus's. Then, by providing that fanatic Proyas with leverage, If it hadn't been for the man's threats of avenging his dear old tutor, Eleazarus would never have allowed the Scarlet Spires to join the Holy War on the South Bank. Six sorcerers of rank fell to Phanum Bowman armed with Kore at the Battle of Anrorat. Ukrumu, Calasthenes, Nayan. Six! And this, Eleazarus knew, was precisely what the Kishorim wanted. To bleed them while jealously guarding their own blood. Oh, he did covet the Gnosis, so much that it almost proved a counterweight to that other word, Kishorim. Almost. That evening at the Sariotic Library, watching this one man resist eight sorcerers of rank with glittering, abstract lights, Eleazarus had envied as he'd never envied before. Such miraculous power, such purity of dispensation. How, he had thought, how? Fucking mandate pigs. After he learned what he needed about the Kishorim, he would see this dog plied in the old way. All things in the world were a lottery, and who knew? Seizing this man might prove an act as significant as destroying the Kishorim in the end. That, Eleazarus decided, was Iacchus's problem. He could not fathom the fact that certain rewards made even the most desperate gambles worthwhile. He knew nothing of hope. Canv addicts never seemed to know anything of hope. The Sempis seemed more than a river in the crossing. Esmanet had ridden behind Serwe to a nearby Enrithi ferry, both terrified of floating on a beast's back and amazed by the girl's native ability to ride. She was Sepalorin, Serwe explained. She'd been born astride a saddle. Which meant, Esmanet thought in a moment of uncommon bitterness, with her legs spread wide. Afterward, standing in the shade of hissing leaves, she looked across the river to the denuded north bank. The barrenness saddened her, reminded her of her heart and why she had to leave. But the distance. A terrifying sense of finality seized her, a certainty that the Sempis, whose waters she'd thought kind, was in fact ruthlessly vindictive and would brook no return. I can swim. I know how to swim. Kellis clasped her about the shoulder. The world looks south, he said. Returning to the Conryan encampment was far less difficult than she feared. Proyas had pitched camp beyond the high walls of Amygnatis, the only great city on the south bank. Because of this, they found themselves part of a great stream of market-bound traffic, bands of horsemen, wains, barefooted penitents, all crowding the side of the road where the shade of palms was deepest. But rather than vanishing into the crowd, they found themselves beset by people, mostly men of the Tusk, but some camp followers as well, all begging to be touched or blessed by the warrior prophet. Word of his stand against the Kyrgwi, Serwe explained, had further confirmed him in the hearts of many people. They were fairly mobbed by the time they reached the camp. He no longer rebukes them, Esmanet said, watching in astonishment. Serwe laughed. Isn't it wonderful? And it was. It was. There was Kellis, the man who had teased her so many times about their fire, walking among adoring masses, smiling, touching cheeks, uttering warm and encouraging words. There was Kellis, the warrior prophet. He looked up to them, grinned, and winked. Pressed against the girl's back in the saddle, Esmanet could feel Serwe shiver in delight, and for an instant she experienced a pang of savage jealousy. Why did she always lose? Why did the gods hate her so? Why not someone else, someone deserving? Why not Serwe? But shame followed hard on these thoughts. Kellis had come for her. Kellis, this man whom others worshipped, had come out of concern for her. He does this for Akamian, for his teacher. Proyas had posted pickets around the outskirts of the Conryan camp, primarily because of the furor surrounding Kellis, Serwe explained, and they soon found themselves walking unmolested through long canvas alleys. Esmanet had told herself she feared returning because it would stir too many recollections, but losing those recollections was what she truly feared. Her refusal to leave their old camp had been rash, desperate, pathetic. Kellis had shown her that. But remaining had fortified her somehow, or so it seemed when she thought about it. There was the clutching sense of defensiveness, the certainty that she must protect Akamian's surroundings. She'd even refused to touch the chipped clay bowl he'd used for his tea that final morning. By describing his absence in such heartbreaking detail, such things had become, it seemed to her, fetishes, charms that would secure his return. And there was the sense of desolate pride. Everyone had fled, but she remained. She remained. She would look across the abandoned fields, at the fire pits becoming earthen, at the paths scuffed through the grasses, and all the world would seem a ghost. Only her loss would seem real. Only Akamian. Wasn't there some glory, some grace in that? Now she was moving on, no matter what Kella said about hearth and family. Did that mean she was leaving Akka behind as well? She wept while Kellis helped her pitch Akamian's tent, so small and threadbare, in the shadow of the grand brocaded pavilion he shared with Serwe. But she was grateful, so very grateful. She had assumed the first few nights would be awkward, but she was wrong. Kellis was too generous, and Serwe too innocent for her to feel anything other than welcome. From time to time, Kellis would make her laugh, simply to remind her, as Minette suspected, that she could still feel joy. Otherwise, he would either share her sorrow or withdraw, so she might suffer in seclusion. Serwe was, well, Serwe. Sometimes she would seem utterly oblivious to Esmenet's grief and act as though nothing had changed, as though Akamian might at any moment come strolling down the winding alley, laughing or quarreling with Zynemus. And though Esmenet found the thought of this offensive, she found it peculiarly comforting in practice. It was nice to pretend. Other times, Serwe would seem absolutely devastated, for her, for Akamian, as well as for herself. Part of this was the pregnancy, as Minette knew. She herself had wept and laughed like a madwoman while carrying her daughter. But as Minette found it particularly difficult to bear. She would dutifully ask Serwe what was wrong, would always be gentle, but her thoughts would fill her with shame. If Serwe said she cried for Akamian, Esmenet would wonder why. Had they been lovers for more than one night? If Serwe said she cried for her, Esmenet would be indignant. What? Was she that pathetic? And if Serwe simply seemed to wallow, Esmenet would find herself disgusted. How could anyone be so selfish? Afterward, Esmenet would berate herself. What would Akamian think of such bitter, spiteful thoughts? How disappointed he'd be. Esme, he'd say. Esme, please. And she'd spend watch after sleepless watch, remembering all her horrid words, all her petty cruelties, and begging the gods for forgiveness. She didn't mean them. How could she? On her third night, she heard a soft tapping against her tent flap. When she pulled it aside, Serwe pressed in, smelling of smoke, oranges, and jasmine. The half-naked girl knelt in the gloom, crying. Esmenet already knew Kellis hadn't returned because she'd been listening. He had his councils and, of course, his growing congregation. Sercha? She asked, overcome by the motherly weariness of having to console those who suffered far less than herself. What is it, Sercha?
Please, Esme. Please, I beg you.
Please, what, Sercha? What do you mean? The girl hesitated. Her eyes were little more than glittering points in the gloom.
Don't steal him, Serwe suddenly cried. Don't steal him from me.
Esmenet laughed, but softly, so as not to bruise the girl's feelings.
Steal Kellis? She said.
Please, Esme, you're so beautiful. Almost as beautiful as me, but you're smart, too. You speak to him the way other men speak to him. I've heard you.
Sercha, I love Akka. I love Kellis too, but not the way you fear. Please, you mustn't fear. I couldn't bear it if you feared me, Sercha.
Esmenet had thought herself sincere, but afterward, as she nestled against Serwe's slender back, she found herself exulting in the thought of Serwe's fear. She curled the girl's blonde hair between her fingers, thinking of the way Serwe had swept it across Akamian's chest. How easy, she wondered. Would it yank from her scalp?
Why did you lie with Akka? Why?
The following morning, Esmonet awoke stricken with remorse. Hatred, as the Sumni said, was a rapacious house guest, and lingered only in hearts fat with pride. Esmonet's heart had grown very thin. She stared at the girl in the tinted light. Serwe had rolled in her sleep, and now lay with her angelic face turned to Esmonet. Her right hand cupped the bulge of her stomach. She breathed, quiet as a babe. How could such beauty dwell in a slumbering face? For a time, Esmonet pondered what it was she thought she saw. There was a peculiar sense of sneakiness, the thrill of one-sided witness so familiar to children. This was what made Esmonet grin, but there was far more. The aura of dormant life, the premonition of death, the wonder of seeing the unruly carnival of human expression enclosed in the stillness of a single point. There was a sense of truth, a recognition that all faces held this one point in common. This, Esmonet knew, was her face, as it was Akamian's, or even Kellis's. But more than anything, there was a glorious vulnerability. The sleeping throat, the Nilnameshi proverb went, was easily cut. Was this not love? To be watched while you slept? She was crying when Serwe awoke. She watched the girl blink, focus, and frown.
Why?
Serwe asked. Esmonet smiled.
Because you're so beautiful, she said. So perfect.
Serwe's eyes flashed with joy. She rolled onto her back, stretching her arms into the stuffy air.
I know,
she cried, rolling her shoulders in a little jig. She looked to Esmonet, bounced her eyebrows up and down.
Everybody wants me, she laughed. Even you.
Little bitch, Esmonet gasped, raising her hands as though to claw at her eyes. Kellis was already at the fire when they tumbled from the tent, laughing and squealing. He shook his head, as perhaps a man should. From that day, Esmonet found herself tending to Serwe with even greater kindness. It was so strange, so confusing, the friendship she'd found with this girl, this pregnant child who had taken a prophet as a lover. Even before Akamian had left for the library, she'd wondered what it was Kellis saw in Serwe. Certainly, it had to be more than her beauty, which was, Esmonet often thought, nothing short of otherworldly. Kellis saw hearts, not skin, no matter how smooth or marble white, and Serwe's heart had seemed so flawed. Joyous and open, certainly, but also vain, petulant, peevish, and wanton. But now Esmonet wondered whether these very flaws held the secret of her heart's perfection, for she'd glimpsed that perfection while watching her sleep. For an instant, she'd glimpsed what only Kellis could see, the beauty of frailty, the splendor of imperfection. She had witnessed, she realized, witnessed truth. She could find no proper words, but she felt better for it, revived somehow. That morning, Kellis had looked at her and had nodded, in a frank, admiring manner that reminded her of Zynemus. He said nothing, because nothing needed to be said, or so it seemed. Perhaps, she thought, truth wasn't unlike sorcery. Perhaps those who see truth simply see each other. Later, before she left with Serwe to scrounge through the half-abandoned bazaars of Amagnatis, Kellis assisted her with her reading. Despite her protestations, he'd given her the Chronicle of the Tusk as a primer. Simply holding the leather-bound manuscript filled her with dread. The look of it, the smell of it, even the rasping creak of its spine spoke of righteousness and irrevocable judgment. The pages seemed inked in iron. Every word she sounded out possessed an anxiousness all its own. Every bird-track column threatened the next.
I need not, she told Kellis, read the warrant of my own damnation.
What does it say? Kellis asked, ignoring her tantrum.
That I'm filth.
What does it say, Esme? She returned to the exhausting trial of wrestling sounds from marks and words from sounds. The day was desert hot, particularly in the city, where the stone and the mud brick soaked up the sun and seemed to redouble its heat. Esmonet retired early that night, and for the first time in many days, fell asleep without crying for Akamian. She awoke to what the Nansur called fool's morning. Her eyes simply fluttered open, and she found herself alert, even though the darkness and the temperature told her the morning lay many watches away. She frowned at the entrance to the tent, which had been pulled open. Her bare feet jutted from her blankets. Moonlight bathed them in the sandaled feet of a man.
"Such interesting company you keep," Sarcella said.
Screaming never occurred to her. For a heartbeat or two, his presence seemed as proper as it seemed impossible. He lay beside her, his head propped on his elbow, his large brown eyes glittering with amusement. Beneath white, gold-floriated vestments, he wore a shrile gown with a tusk embroidered across its chest. He smelled of sandalwood and other ritual incenses she couldn't identify.
"Sarcellus," she murmured.
How long had he been watching her?
"You never did tell the sorcerer about me, did you?"
"No."
He shook his head in rueful mockery.
"Naughty whore."
The sense of unreality drained away, and the first true pang of fear struck her.
"What do you want, Sarcellus?"
"You."
"Leave."
"Your prophet isn't what you think he is. You do know that."
Fear had become terror. She knew full well how cruel he could be to those who fell outside the narrow circle of his respect, but she'd always thought herself within that circle, even after she'd left his tent. But something had happened. Somehow, she understood she meant nothing, absolutely nothing, to the man now gazing upon her.
"Leave now, Sarcellus."
The Knight Commander laughed.
"But I need you, Esme. I need your help. There's gold."
"I'll scream.
I'm warning. There's life."
Sarcellus snarled. Somehow his hand had clamped about her mouth. She didn't need to feel the prick to know he held a knife to her throat.
"Listen, whore. You've made a habit of begging at the wrong table. The sorcerer is dead. Your prophet will soon follow. Now I ask, where does that leave you?"
He swept the covers away, exposed her to the warm night air. She flinched, sobbed as the knife point swizzled across her moonlit skin.
"Eh, old whore? What will you do when your peach loses its pucker, Whom will you bed then? How will you end, I wonder? Will you be fucking lepers, or will you be sucking scared little boys for scraps of bread?"
She wet herself in terror. Sarcellus breathed deep, as though savoring the bouquet of her humiliation. His eyes laughed.
"Is that understanding I smell?"
Esmanette, sobbing, nodded against the iron fingers. Sarcellus smirked, removed his hand. She shrieked, screamed until it seemed her throat must bleed. Then Kellis held her, and she was drawn from the tent to the glowing coals of the fire pit. She heard shouts, saw men crowding about them with torches, heard voices rumbling in Cynhyrian. Somehow she explained what happened, shuddering and sobbing within the frame of Kellis's strong arms. After what seemed both heartbeats and days, the commotion passed. People returned to what sleep remained to them. The terror receded, replaced by the exhausted throb of embarrassment. Kellis told her he would complain to Gotian, but that there would be very little anyone could do.
"Sarcellus is a knight commander," Kellis said,
"and she was just a dead sorcerer's whore. Naughty whore." Esmanette refused Serwe's offer to stay with her and Kellis in their pavilion, but accepted her offer to wash with her laver. Afterward, Kellis followed her to her tent.
"Serwe cleaned it for you," he said. "She replaced your bedding."
Esmanette started crying yet again.
When had she become so weak, so pathetic? "How could you leave me? Why did you leave me?"
She crawled into the tent as though diving into a burrow. She hid her face in clean woolen blankets. She smelled sandalwood. Bearing his lantern, Kellis followed, sat cross-legged over her.
"He's gone, Esmanette. Sarcellus won't return. Not after tonight.
Even if nothing happens, the questions will embarrass him. What man doesn't suspect other men of acting on their own lusts?"
"You don't understand," she gasped. How could she tell him?
All this time fearing for a Commian, even daring to mourn him, and still—
"I lied to him," she exclaimed. "I lied to Akka."
Kellis frowned.
"What do you mean?"
After he left me in Sumna, the consult came to me. The consult, Kellis. And I knew that Inrau's death had been no suicide. I knew it. But I never told Akka. Oh, sweet Sejanus, I never told him. And now he's gone, Kellis, gone.
Breathe, Esme, breathe. What does this have to do with Sarcellus?
I don't know. That's the mad part. I don't know.
You were lovers, Kellis said, and she went still, like a child confronted by a wolf. Kellis had always known her secret since that night at the shrine above Asgiliac, when he'd interrupted her in Sarcellus. So why her terror now?
For a time you thought you loved Sarcellus, Kellis continued. You even judged a commune against him. You judged and found a commune wanting.
I was a fool, she cried. A fool.
How could she be such a fool? No man is your equal, love, no man. A commune was weak, Kellis said.
But I loved him for those weaknesses, don't you see? That's why I loved him.
I loved him in truth, and that's why you could never go to him. To go to him while you shared Sarcellus's bed would be to accuse him of those very weaknesses he couldn't bear. So you stayed away, fooled yourself into thinking you searched for him when you were hiding all the while.
How can you know these things?
She sobbed. But no matter how much you lied to yourself, you knew. And that's why you could never tell a commune about what happened in Sumna, no matter how much he needed to know, because you knew he wouldn't understand, and you feared what he would see. Despicable, selfish, hateful, polluted. But Kellis could see. He'd always seen.
Don't look at me,
she cried. Look at me. But I do, Esme. I do look. And what I see fills me with wonder. And these narcotic words, so warm and so close, so very close, stilled her. Her pillow ached against her cheek, and the hard earth beneath her mat bruised, but all was warm and all was safe. He blew out his lantern, then quietly withdrew from her tent. The warm memory of his fingers continued to comb her hair.
Obviously famished, Serwe had started eating early. A pot of rice boiled on the fire, which Kellis periodically opened and closed, adding onions, spices, and Shigeki pepper. Ordinarily, Esmenet would have cooked, but Kellis had her reading aloud from the Chronicle of the Tusk, laughing at her rare fumbles and showering her with encouragement. She was reading the Canticles, the old Tusk laws, many of which the latter prophet had rescinded in the tractate. Together they wondered that children were stoned to death for striking their parents, or that when a man murdered some other man's brother, his own brother was executed. Then she read, "Suffer not a..." She recognized the words because of sheer repetition. Sounding out the following word, she said, "Whore," and stopped. She glanced at Kellis and angrily recited, "Suffer not a whore to live, for she maketh a pit of her womb." Her ears burned. She squelched a sudden urge to cast the book into the flames. Kellis gazed back, utterly unsurprised.
"He's been waiting for me to reach this passage. All along."
"Give me the book," he said, his tone unreadable. She did as she was told. In a fluid, almost thoughtless motion, he pulled his knife from the ceremonial sheath he wore about his waist. Pinching the blade near the tip, he proceeded to scratch the ink of the offending statement from the vellum. For several heartbeats, Esmenet couldn't comprehend what he was doing. She simply stared, a petrified witness. Once the column was clean, he leaned back to survey his handiwork. "Better," he said, as though he just scraped mold from bread. He turned to pass the book back. Esmenet couldn't bring herself to touch it.
But you can't do that."
"No?" He pressed the book into her hands. She fairly tossed it into the dust on her far side.
"That's scripture, Kellis. The Tusk. The Holy Tusk."
"I know. The warrant of your damnation." Esmenet gawked like a fool.
But
Kella scowled and shook his head, as though astonished she could be so dense. Just who, Esme, do you think I am? Serwe chirped with laughter, even clapped her hands.
Who?
Esmenet stammered. It was the most she could manage. Other than in rare anger or jest, she'd never heard Kellis speak with such presumption.
Yes, Kellis repeated.
Who? His voice seemed satin thunder. He looked as eternal as a circle. Then Esmenet glimpsed it, the shining gold about his hands. Without thinking, she rolled to her knees before him, pressed her face into the dust.
Please, please, I'm nothing.
Then Serwe hiccuped. Suddenly, absurdly, it was just Kellis before her, laughing, drawing her up from the dust, bidding her to eat her supper.
Better,
he said, as she numbly resumed her place beside him. Her whole skin burned and prickled. He nodded toward the open book while filling his mouth with rice. Bewildered, flustered, she blushed and looked down. She nodded to her bowl.
I knew this. I always knew this.
The difference was that Kellis now knew as well. His presence burned in her periphery. How, she breathlessly wondered, how could she ever look into his eyes again? Throughout her entire life, she'd looked upon things and people that stood apart. She was Esmenet, and that was her bowl, the Emperor's silver, the Shrya's man, the god's ground, and so on. She stood here, and those things there. No longer. Everything, it seemed, radiated the warmth of his skin, the ground beneath her bare feet, the mat beneath her buttocks, and for a mad instant, she was certain that if she raised her fingers to her cheek, she would feel the soft curls of a flaxen beard, that if she turned to her left, she would see Esmenet hovering motionless over her rice bowl. Somehow, everything had become here, and everything here had become him. Kellis. She breathed in. Her heart battered her breast. He scraped the passage clean. In a single exhalation, it seemed, a lifetime of condemnation slipped from her, and she felt shriven, truly shriven. One breath, and she was absolved. She experienced a kind of lucidity, as though her thoughts had been cleansed like water strained through bright white cloth. She thought she should cry, but the sunlight was too sharp, the air too clear for weeping. Everything was so certain. He scraped the passage clean. Then she thought of Akamian. The air smelled of wine and vomit and armpits. Torches flared through the murk, painting mud brick walls in oranges and blacks, illuminating slivers of the drunken warriors who crowded the dark. A bearded jawline here, a furrowed brow there, a glistening eye, a bloody fist upon a pommel. Neyur Ur Skiotha walked among them, through the tight alleys of the Hepa, Amignatus's ancient district of revels. He shouldered his way forward, moving intently as though he had a destination. Laughter and light boomed through wide thrown doors. Shigeki girls giggled, called out in mangled Shaik. Children hawked stolen oranges. Laughing, he thought. All of them laughing.
You're not of the land.
You,
he heard someone cry.
Weeper. Faggot weeper.
You, a young Galeoth man at his side said. Where had he come from? His eyes flashed in wonder, but something about the broken light made his face lurid. His lips looked wanton and feminine, the black hollow of his mouth promising.
You traveled with him. You're his first disciple. His first.
Who?
Him, the warrior prophet.
You beat me, old Banut, his father's brother, cried, for fucking him the way you fucked his father.
Neyur seized the man, yanked him close.
Who?
Prince Kellis of Atrathau. You're the Skilvendi who found him on the steppe, who delivered him to us.
Yes, the Dunyane.
Somehow he'd forgotten about him. He glimpsed a face blow open, like steppe grasses in a gust. He felt a palm, warm and tender, upon his thigh. He began shaking.
You're more than the people. I am of the people,
he grated. The man wrenched ineffectually at his wrists.
Please, he hissed. I thought...
Nayor tossed him to the ground, glared at the shadowy procession of passers-by.
Did they laugh? I watched you that night. I saw the way you looked at him.
How did he find himself on this track? Where was he riding?
What did you call me?
He screamed at the prostrate man. He remembered running as hard as he could, away from the black paths worn through the grasses, away from the Yaksh and his father's all-knowing wrath. He found a clutch of sumacs and cleared a hollow in their hidden heart. The weave of green grasses through gray. The smell of earth, of beetles crawling through damp and dark grottos. The smell of solitude and secrecy, under the sky but sheltered from the wind. He pulled the broken pieces from his belt and spread them in breathless wonder. He reassembled them. She was so sad. And so beautiful. Impossibly beautiful. Someone. He was forgetting to hate someone.